When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. Today I have Doug with me and we're going to talk about team dynamics. And what I mean by that is not how to function as a team normally, but how to function as a team when you're dealing with a critically injured patient. And the reason why I came up with this topic is just watching different training scenarios, different courses. I see a lot of teams, a lot of medics struggle when working together as far as everybody's working individually on one patient. They're working on like the lower half of the body, they're working on the upper half of the body, they're not really communicating with each other, and there's nobody really watching the overall, like the global presentation of this patient and making decisions to move the patient further down the field outside of the individual tasks. So today I'm with Doug to get his experience working from especially Baltimore Shock Trauma, very high volume facility. Doug, have you had similar experience witnessing things like this?
Yeah, hey Dennis, absolutely. I've seen, you know, both the good and the bad of team dynamics in my many years as a critical care physician and also training training medics in special operations. Then on the good end, you know, when you have a team that has at least minimally rehearsed the various roles, which we'll get into the details of, I'm sure, the various roles that are required to stabilize a critically injured patient, with a leader who's also rehearsed that role, then things go as well as they possibly can. And when you don't, and everybody is, you know, trying to do their own thing, or everybody's focusing on one thing and nobody's focused on what else is going on, then you have the potential to miss things and for things to go wrong. And sometimes that affects the, sometimes that affects the outcome of the patient. And I've seen that both, you know, in training with medics, I've seen it in AARs from real-world scenarios in some of our soft AORs, and I've definitely seen it in the hospital, and I've experienced it firsthand. You know, I've been an ineffective leader of code situations, you know, code basically where something life-threatening is happening and you have to move quickly to stabilize the patient, and I think I've been an effective leader in hopefully more situations than ineffective.
Yeah, the scenario I'm having in my mind is there was a patient, it was a blast patient, had an evisceration, had an amputation, had a some facial trauma, and the team, you know, the team as a whole individually, they're very, they're stellar operators. Had I taken everybody away except one patient, I think they could have handled it very well. But when they got put together, they missed things like the amputation, not putting a tourniquet on it. All four people took turns going through the bowel looking for tiny little bleeds, but the amp was still bleeding. They missed a downside wound that was sucking air. The crike went in backwards, so the tube opening was actually at the mouth versus down the respiratory tree. and they just kind of stepped all over each other. So that's why I came up with this podcast, to hopefully get people to start thinking about how to train and how to organize themselves. But speaking of organizations, so, you know, places like Baltimore Shock Trauma, very high volume trauma facilities, how do they tackle this team dynamics? How do they build a team?
Sure. Well, at Shock, where I trained in my for part of my critical care fellowship, you know, they saw so much trauma on a daily basis that they were basically able to just protocolize, you know, literally the positions around the patient where people stood, and the role of the person standing in that position. And so, you know, you knew that if you were at the head of the bed on the patient's right side, lying face up, that you were going to be assisting the person who placed the IV and hanging fluids. And then if you were the person's, you know, next on the patient's right, so closer toward the foot, you were going to be IV access. The two people at the head of the bed were always anesthesia, and I trained a couple of months on the trauma anesthesia service, you know, for airway management, and one of those people was always placing the airway, providing mass ventilations first, assessing the airway. Assessing the airway. Determining whether a definitive airway needed to be done or assisted ventilations, providing assisted ventilations, whether or not an airway was going to be placed if those were needed, and then as a bridge to placing the airway. And then the second person was, you know, giving you all your airway tools and your drugs and pushing those drugs for you on your command. Everybody on the patient's left was the surgical team that were doing the fast exam. And the primary survey, and calling them out to a recorder who was always closer to the foot of the bed, kind of away from the fray, but within earshot to hear everything. And then the quarterback, the person who was overall, you know, running the whole trauma code, would stand at the foot of the bed, basically just observing. And that's really the role of the team leader, is to observe, and that's how you cut down on those incidences where things like an amputation are missed, things like a sucking chest wound or on the backside are missed, because they are continually running through this internal loop of our internal checklist of, you know, we've done this, we haven't done that, and that's basically all you do. And as soon as you get involved in doing something, that will knock that checklist loop off of its rails, and you can get stuck kind of on a single thing. And that's where I've seen, you know, resuscitations go off the rails the most, both in training and in real world. And you know, you do have to address life-threatening things as they happen, but what you can't let happen is to address a life-threatening thing and then forget to keep going with wherever you left off. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether that's completing a primary survey, which in your case it was, you know, because a primary survey would have caught both the leg wound and the chest wound, or doing a secondary survey, or completing a fast exam. And we have several examples from theater that I've reviewed where, you know, a primary neurologic injury was diagnosed, you know, severed spine, severe TBI, and a secondary internal bleeding injury and blunt trauma was missed, either for hours and in one case for days. Because, you know, I wasn't there, so I don't want to point fingers, but you know, my suspicion is that if you had had somebody quarterbacking that, or at least QCing it, you know, from that seeing the whole field standpoint, you would have said, oh, you know, how far did we get in our primary survey? Oh, we only got to hear, well, let's do a fast exam, that type of thing. So that, you know, at Shock Trauma, is sort of automatic. You knew by where you were standing what you were going to be doing, and you had so many hundreds of reps that it just became automatic. You know, at the military hospital they worked at, that was lower volume, but we still had people come in the door. both with traumatic and both with traumatic cases and also non-traumatic cases, cardiac arrest in the field, or respiratory arrest in the field. What would happen is, since you didn't know who was going to be on that day and who was going to come when the overhead code was called, you generally had some time to react once you got to the emergency room until EMS got there with a patient. And then, you know, there'd still be that recorder, and you would every position would check in. You know, anesthesia is here for airway, great. Surgery's here for trauma, great. You know, critical care is here for, you know, whatever, oversight, ultrasound exam, central line placement, you know, other stuff. And everybody would sort of, you know, look at each other across the room and say, here are my roles. You know, I've got somebody on meds, pharmacy's here for meds, nurses here for IV access, you know, that type of stuff. So it wouldn't be so much automatic that everybody knew by where they stood what they should be doing, but everybody had a chance, everybody knew what roles needed to be filled, and everybody filled those roles until they were all complete. And then once that happened, everybody else got out of the room. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have too much chaos.
So this is kind of a softball question, but you're talking about different kind of stations around the patient's body.
Correct.
And then you have the quarterback, the team leader at the foot of the bed. Why do you even really need that quarterback at the foot of the bed? Why can't you just have your specialties, the people that are very good at a particular task, why can't you just have them descend on the patient and do their thing?
Again, because of the phenomenon that you get drawn into whatever it is that you're doing, to the extent that you can miss things. And you know, I don't care how expert you are, that's going to happen. I mean, it's happened to me. Not that, you know, I consider myself a great expert, but I've seen it happen, you know, so many times. And people who study the dynamics of mission critical teams, you know, we'll tell you that there has to be some oversight, somebody, you know, some check on the group, to make sure things aren't getting missed, and also to make sure that things that are asked for or things that are said need to be done actually are done and aren't missed. Mm. You know, very frequently during resuscitations. In fact, I can't think of a single one where it hasn't been done. Whoever's leading the resuscitation will ask the person who's documenting, you know, have we missed anything? When was that drug given? Was this, was a tourniquet applied? Was a fast exam applied? And they'll basically cross-reference their internal checklist of what needs to be done with the recorder to make sure that their internal checklist was actually accomplished. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes, even as the team leader, you think that something's done and it hasn't been. Mm-hmm. And so even the team leader has a backup.
Right.
Now, I realize that in combat, you know, you're not going to have all those assets, but there still is a way, you know, there still is a way to do this with fewer assets and less experience.
Right. Speaking of that, so how do we take a well organized and experienced team like at Baltimore and apply that to, you know, the operational environment? Because sometimes, you know, I'm the only medic, I'm the only person treating. Sometimes, you know, I have several people, I have lots of help. So how do I take a concept like that and adapt it for myself?
Yeah, I mean, if it's you alone, that's a bad day. I'm a big believer in written checklists. You know, the T-Tri-C card has a bunch of things that need to be filled out. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you've got that set off to one side and you're working a patient solo and you look over the card, you know, and you realize, oh, I haven't finished a primary survey. Mm-hmm. You know, or you look at the schematic of the casualty, you know, that should prompt you to say, have I done a primary survey or not? And on the prolonged field care flow sheet, you know, there's a good checklist along the right side, a little bit more, you know, later in the resuscitation, but have I done all these things, or, you know, do these things apply to my patient, and if they do, have I done them? Mm-hmm. Hopefully, if you're getting into prolonged field care as a solo medic, you are getting some help. But I'll look at the team more, and that is, you know, you basically just need to train as a team. You know, the days where, you know, doc goes to medical training and the team, you know, does all their stuff, don't really work when in a prolonged field care environment where evacuation could be delayed by hours to up to, you know, days potentially. And the time to train the team is not when you're taking your first casualty, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the medics in one of the SF groups who took a casualty, blunt force trauma due to a motor vehicle accident of some U.S. Embassy personnel, you know, within less than 24 hours, him arriving in country with half of his ODA. And one of his AAR comments was like, man, I wish we had trained as a team more, because I was just mentally spent and task saturated by, within hours, mm-hmm, of managing this patient. And he had him in a local military hospital, but half of his battle was quality controlling, you know, the local national providers, mm-hmm, because their standard of care was different from our standards of care.
Right. Now, as far as medical training, you know, the medic training his teammates and the basics of, you know, MARCH and T-TRI-C and these individual skills, how would you train for them to work as a team on, you know, a one patient, two patients?
So, good point. I mean, there's definitely two different scenarios. So, you have one patient, the whole team can take care of the patient, and then you have, you know, a MASCAL, which is, you know, MASCAL is just defined as any number of patients that overwhelm your resources, which for, you know, split ODA or a smaller team could be two.
Right.
But certainly a MASCAL, you're going to react differently, mm-hmm, than you would with one primary casualty, especially if it's one of your teammates. However, there's systems that can be applied to both, and you basically need to train on both. You know, you need to, if a MASCAL is going to be in your wheelhouse operationally, you need to train, you know, how to triage, how to write basic notes, how to do basic exams, and stabilize life-threatening conditions, and keep moving, you know, until all the patients are stabilized and triaged, and then you re-engage, you know, your sickest patients in terms of monitoring and follow-up and additional steps that need to be done. That's one very specific scenario that needs to be trained. And again, there's a leader for that. Probably the person who's doing the triage should be the medic. Mm-hmm. It should be the medic, and leave all the life-threatening, stabilization of life-threatening interventions to the other team members. You know, you could have a guy, you know, a bleeder guy. You could have an airway guy, mm-hmm, and you cross-train your teams to that. And airway, you know, really, most of the time will be positioning and mass ventilation. And a lot of times it's just positioning. Put in an NPA will get you out of a lot of airway difficulties. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but more than 50%. You know, and bleeding, everybody on the team should have bleeding control as a reflex. And you know, just get some reps on that in your training. And if you train as a team, then when it happens in real life, you know, you'll be better prepared. Every rep increases your ability to do better the next time. And so one rep is better than none, two is better than one, five is better than four. You know, you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be a lot. But, you know, you wouldn't train for clearing buildings individually and then come together in the stack for the first time. Medicine, you know, treating a critically ill or critically injured casualty or MASCAL is the same thing. It's the same complexity as a building clearing operation, And it requires the same amount of training and oversight. You've always, you know, you've got somebody who, when you're clearing buildings, you've got somebody who's trying to, you know, see the whole field and know where everybody is, and how things are going, and direct the team or teams through those buildings. Mm-hmm. Same thing with medicine. It's exactly the same thing. For one casualty, you know, you're really going to want to train. Definitely, you're going to want to train the team, the entire team, on assessment. Like, everybody in the team should be able to do a primary survey, right? From head to toe, front side and back side. They should know how to, you know, roll the patient, you know, secure the C-spine, roll the patient safely, check the backside, and stop bleeding, or perform critical interventions as they come to them, nasal airway, decompress the chest, stop massive hemorrhage, and keep moving. Don't get stuck. And so if you train that don't get stuck reflex on the entire team, chances are if the entire team encounters a casualty, even if five of the six members get stuck on something, the sixth one will be like, hey, what about this? And that's what you want. You want everybody in the team to be empowered to say, what about this? We missed this. We need to do this. Mm-hmm. This isn't working. You know, realizing that the medic is going to have the most experience and certainly have the most procedural skill, you want to hold that procedural skill out to the very last and only use it if it's needed, because once the medic dives in to do something, then his thought immediately focuses on that task and misses seeing the field. So the more you can train the team to do more stuff, IV placements, hanging fluids, you know, life-saving interventions, head-to-toe surveys, monitoring in terms of vital signs and documentation, the better you reserve that medic mm-hmm. to be your quarterback and see the whole field. And you just have to train it. And the way to, you know, the way to train it is with people who have been resuscitators or are resuscitators in their clinical practice. You know, very experienced medics, probably PAs, yes, docs for sure, mentoring them mm-hmm. and kind of coaching them along the way. Hey, back out, look at this.
Right.
And not just stand back with a clipboard and evaluate them, but watch them and be an engaged coach.
Right. You know? And being it's a definite skill, is being able to at least mentally step back from the situation and start to think globally about, you know, this is present, this is present, this is present. Okay, this is what the problem actually is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start attacking the problem this way.
Right.
You know, we'll do our life-saving interventions as a stopgap, but he needs to be moved in this direction
mm-hmm.
by, you know, whatever procedure. And the only way to even see that is being able to step back sometimes and, you know, and think a little bit, not necessarily disengaged, but kind of isolated from, you know, what is actually going on.
Yeah, and have a, you know, as you're training, you know, have a mental checklist that you run through. You know, March E is a great checklist. That's the one I would probably emphasize for medics. You know, for me as an intensive care doc, we treat organ system failure, and so the mantra that we get into is just running through the organ systems from neurologic at the top to endocrine at the most global, mm-hmm. you know, moving first through organs and then into, you know, widespread organs like the blood and the endocrine system. And I just run through those checklists as we're doing something, and we're like, hey, you know, is there something to address here? Has it been addressed? Is there something that is going to need to be addressed? How are we going to monitor it? You know, what do I want to know? You know, right. Say for blood pressure, you know, we've given him a bolus, you know, let's recheck it in 30 minutes. If it's stable, great. If not, let's give him another bolus. If he doesn't respond to the second bolus, let's start epinephrine, let's say in a septic patient. Right. Or if it's a bleeding patient, you know, let's give him blood. And, you know, if it looks like we're giving a second unit of blood and he could be headed toward a massive transfusion, let's make sure, you know, we're calling for platelets and plasma
mm-hmm.
from the blood bank early to have it. You know, better to have it and not need it.
Right.
Right. So... but again, it's training, and then what you and I were talking about before the podcast started, you know, mentored repetitions or coached repetitions, and that's right. One of the reasons why you know, when we train our medics to try to have people who are experienced resuscitators, who've been a team leader in trauma resuscitations or ER resuscitations, mentoring the team, and I tell the cadre, hey, this is on-the-job training, this is not evaluation. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not standing there to see which of the items on your instructor checklist they're doing and not doing and giving them a go or a no-go. There are other opportunities to do that. This is pre-mission training. We're trying to, you know, build up their education, build up their confidence, build up their cohesiveness as a team. Mm-hmm. So if you see something, you know, coach them through it, you know, and teach them along the way, and they'll pick up on that and internalize it and do better at it the next time.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, like anything else, it comes down to training. It comes down to practice. It comes down to just repetitions, even just finding out how of a nut roll this can really turn out to be if it's not done correctly.
Right. And for the medic, that's going to be one of the hardest things. You know, honestly, in some of my medical training that I've done, I've seen team sergeants do the overall observation and leadership role better than the medics, because the expectation on medics for so long has been, hey, doc, here's a sick patient, go do everything. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be, in some cases, a harder reflex, you know, for the medic to break out and be the medical leader and direct the team. And so, you know, train out of your comfort zone, you know. Mm-hmm. And I definitely learned that in my residency, in my medical residency, you know, when I first started doing, you know, notional resuscitations with simulated patients in a simulation lab with the whole team, you know, I would dive in and I'd want to do the airway or I'd want to place the central line. And you just have to work at it to back out and let other people who are technically competent, who could do those things but may not have the expertise to see the whole field, let them do that, and you take yourself out of it and force yourself. And maybe talk with your team sergeant and say, hey, you know, my role for this medical training is I want to be the leader and the observer and the manager. If you see me getting out of that role, you know, whack me on the back of the head and tell me, hey, doc, step back. You know, we got this.
Right.
And I've seen that happen, and it's been very effective.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Well, thank you, Doug. I think this is a great podcast, and hopefully we can at least help people start thinking about how to train and develop themselves in the team resuscitation, team environment of this.
Thanks, Dennis.
All right. That's it for today's podcast. Be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Great boy is waiting there for you.